What I would like to do during lab day is tackle at least one of the lab reports that we have outstanding, and I want to do the kinetics versus thermodynamics lab report, since I'm looking forward to and worried about the lab final. So on the lab final, aside from NMR, the one major topic you're going to have is kinetics versus thermodynamics. And of course, we've already had our theory lecture on the situation that this experiment was designed around, which is that we have these two different starting materials that form two different derivatives, but the one that's the easier one to form is the less stable product. The one that's the tougher one to form is the more stable product. And that's where the kinetic versus thermodynamic control comes from. That discussion we're not going to have again today, except in the level of detail we need to remember what our context is. But today we need to talk about interpreting those results from the lab to figure out which of the products is the kinetic product, which is the thermodynamic product. So, both of those aspects are going to be in the lab quiz. First, just what is kinetic versus thermodynamic control? But then after that, how do we figure out which product is which in the experiment that we performed? So let's write some structures down. I'll call the cyclohexanone compound A, since that's what you used in part A. You react that with semicarbazide. Which acts like hydrazine in that it makes a carbonyl derivative. That for simplicity's sake, I'm going to call A prime. Now we have a similar set of reactions for furaldehyde. Yes.
Are you recording this?
Yes, I am. I'll call the furaldehyde B and the derivative B prime. Now, slightly off topic. Is B, the 2-furaldehyde, aromatic, non-aromatic, or anti-aromatic? Aromatic? B, 2-furaldehyde. Does it have any cyclic part to it? Well, yes, of course. Is that cyclic part planar? Yes, because even if the oxygen was not sp2 hybridized, the other four members of the ring, so all but one of the members, would be planar. So that fifth one will, because of the small size of the ring, be forced to be planar unless we have some unusually unstable molecule. Now, what about those two different lone pairs? Could both lone pairs delocalized and be part of the pi system? Could both lone pairs be part of the pi system? No, because if we were using a p orbital to write where the electron is going in, one p orbital can only fit one pair of electrons. So even if one pair of electrons gets delocalized, which it does, because it's energetically so favorable to become aromatic, then it's just like parole. A lone pair becomes part of a p orbital, becomes delocalized, we have 6 pi electrons, everything conjugated, it's aromatic. But at the same time that happens, another pair of electrons is therefore forced to be perpendicular to ring, just like pyridine's case. So yours is the class section that had imidazole as one of your questions the other day, correct? And that question had a nitrogen where the lone pair was part of the pi system and another nitrogen where the lone pair was not part of the pi system. This is similar, except that both of the pairs of electrons are one atom. They're both just on oxygen. And again, one is going to be part of the pi system, and one is not. And this is a side question here, but since I did address it, let me write it down. And it is aromatic, because first off, the carbonyl doesn't affect whether or not it's aromatic. It may have an influence on the reactivity, but it does not change whether the compound is aromatic or not, because it's outside the ring. And then, this is a combination of the situations that we have for pyridine and pyrrole. One of the oxygen lone pairs will delocalize, be part of the pi system, which forces the other pair of electrons to be perpendicular to it, to be in an sp2 hybridized orbital. So back onto the lab, we had four parts to this experiment. Part A was just so that you could take compound A and make the derivative of it, which we looked up and found out that ideally its melting point should have been 166 degrees. Part B is where we do the same thing. We make just a pure derivative, which is supposed to be at 202 degrees. Now, in real life, though, what were some of your all's results? What are some sample melting points that you got for part A? .163, that's pretty close. How about some others of you? Hello, everybody did this lab, or better have done it. As I commented to one of the other sections, you don't want me to collect your lab books right now and see if you actually have all those melting point temperatures, do you? Okay. So you all were patient or had good technique or both, or lucked into it. There's always that factor. Because the other labs, they had temperatures all over the place for part A. For the most part, lower. The reason I want to comment on that is because you might not have the purest compounds on the planet. Because we didn't do any kind of recrystallization. We just did it, separated it, let it dry out, hoping that that was going to be purification enough. There is also the fact that melting points using the equipment that we have are boring to take. And it is possible that some of you, even while trying to be a little bit careful, might have still heated too quickly to allow thermal equilibrium to become established. Remember that we've discussed this concept of thermal equilibrium, the fact that it takes time for the heat to transfer from that heating element up through first the sample, then up to where the thermometer is. So if you heat it too quickly, the sample still melted at its real melting point, but the thermometer hadn't caught up with that temperature and gives you, therefore, an artificially low value. So my guess is the combination of not doing enough in terms of purification, along with the fact that some of you might have taken the melting point a little too quickly, would explain why the melting points come out lower than they should. But did everybody get lower melting points for compound A than they did for compound B? Yes, okay? And what were some of the example melting points for compound B that you had? 190? 196? 197? Wow, okay. Maybe because the caffeine wore off that you had at 7:30 in the morning, but by the time you get here, it's 12 o'clock. Maybe you all were a little bit mellow, took the melting points a little bit more carefully. But that's good then. At least if you didn't get exactly the numbers you should have, again, with the reasonable assumption that maybe the melting points were taken too quickly and there's some contamination, we got good enough results. Now, what about part C? Well, there were three different things that we did. It was A plus B forming a combination of the derivatives, but we did it at three different temperatures. We did below room temperature, at room temperature, and above room temperature. So let me draw a little picture here on the side to remind us what's going on. And I said this out loud at the very beginning. But a reminder that this is a reaction in which the energies of the transition states are reversed in order compared to the energies of the products. So again, the one that's easier to make is the one that's not the most favorable product, and the one that's hard to make is the most favorable product. So at low temperature, though, where there's not really enough energy for the reaction to reverse, it is going to be essentially the activation barriers in that forward direction that are going to determine the makeup of the product mixture when there's not very much energy around. Whichever barrier it can actually get over is whichever reaction is going to happen. Well, at low temperature, since that means it's going to favor the reaction with the lower activation barrier, it's going to favor which, in this case, is the product that is less favorable. So in other words, at low reaction temperature, we should see the kinetic product. But when we raise the temperature, now rates of both the forward and reverse reactions increases. So even if you form the kinetic product the first time through a reaction, there is time and ability for it to reverse. It gets another shot then at being able to form the thermodynamic product, which once you form the thermodynamic product, that's the lowest energy thing in the system. And so it's the least likely thing to want to reverse, which means it would tend to accumulate. So at high temperature, that means we're going to get the thermodynamic product. Now, room temperature will therefore get some kind of mixture. So there's two comments I'm going to make in a theoretical basis. One, could somebody remind me what causes... Let me back up and describe the situation first. I've got a mixture that is 95% one solid, 5% another one. What is it that causes the combination of those two to potentially have a lower melting point than either of the two pure substances? Why is it that an impurity in one causes its melting point to become lower?
Impact of one may affect the other one to be not. energy to break partial of the intermolecular process between the mixture of the solid crystals.
Correct. What he said. Which actually, he touched on two parts of it. One, there is this equilibrium effect. Because how can two solids mix? They shouldn't. So why is it that a mixture of solids exhibits this behavior? Because as it starts to melt, or as you start to heat up, some molecules are moving fast enough that they temporarily enter the liquid phase. Which once in the liquid phase, then things could mix around a little bit. Ignore that subtle aspect of it. If you just put molecule A with molecule B, they're not going to line up with each other as well as if you just had molecule A or just had molecule B. So if you had what otherwise would be this nice geometric, this repeating pattern of molecules that you mess up because you put some kind of impurity in there, well, that gets in the way of those molecules coming together, which means they don't grip on as tightly on each other. That's what those intermolecular forces are, the things that actually pull molecules together. So if they're not as great, those intermolecular forces, it doesn't take as much energy to overcome them, which means you melt at a lower temperature. But that's not necessarily going to happen in this case. I bring that up as a reminder to say what might be true at the below room temperature or above room temperature runs, where you'll mostly have the kinetic or the thermodynamic products, but maybe not 100%. And therefore, it would be reasonable to have a melting point a little below what it should be for either of those two results. For the middle result, where we have the mix of the two, because there's so much of each compound, that little bit of an effect, which would lower the melting point, may not be there. What I'm trying to say is that if you had a 50-50 mix, it's more likely the melting point is just going to be between the two melting points of the original compounds. At least if the original compounds had drastically different melting points. Which 40 degrees difference is not drastic, but enough that we may end up with a melting point in between the two ranges. So let me ask you, for your below, at, and above room temperature runs, did you have, between the three of them, a pattern of increasing or decreasing temperatures as you go from one to next? The increased from below to room to above room temperature, did your melting points increase? Yes. What were some of your rough melting points for the below temperature run? 160, 168, 130, 53. In other words, all melting points closer to the A derivative with 166. What about the above temperature runs? 189? 170, a little low, but 178, but still higher than the original one, higher than the first one, closer to matching the part B derivative. Well, what does that mean? That means the derivative of A is the kinetic product. That means the derivative of B is the thermodynamic. But here's a note that I have to make, and I'll explain it, or try to explain it, and I know this might be confusing, but it is an important point. There is not necessarily any connection between thermodynamic stability and melting point. What I mean is this. Yes, it is true that the reaction that occurred at low temperature, which is the kinetic product, was the lower melting point product. And yes, it is true that the mixture that was generated at high reaction temperature generated the product that has the higher melting point. That is coincidence. It is perfectly possible that in another reaction, another similar competition, we might have generated a product formed at low temperature that has a high melting point. And we might have made a product formed at high temperature that has a lower melting point. And that's because melting point is simply determined by interactions between molecules. Nothing to do with the energy needed to create those molecules. So in other words, the structure of the molecule, how it forms a crystal, that's what determines melting point, not how the molecule was made. Now, I'm sure that it's possible that you will find other cases where there's a correspondence between the favorability of a product and its melting point, but there isn't necessarily one at all. So it's, one last time, the fact that we end up with something that matches the compound from part A, that is what identifies it as being the kinetic or thermodynamic product. And we identified that the low temperature run produced compound A on the basis of melting point, which is how we said it was the kinetic product. And then again, because when we did the reaction at above room temperature, we produced a product that was close in melting point to B, that's why we said that B is the thermodynamic product. Now, to corroborate our results, we have part E. Because in part E, we did two reactions. One of which was to take the product of A. So the way I've notated here, that means A prime. And react it with B. If A prime can reverse, then aside from reforming A, you would also have semicarbazide around. That semicarbazide could react with B, and that would cause then B prime to be formed. Of course, the only way that this would happen is if B prime was the thermodynamic product. Because the what I said a moment ago, if we made that product, it would likely not want to reverse. So if A was the thermodynamic product, this reaction would not happen, because it wouldn't want to reverse. But if it does reverse, that means A is the kinetic product, which is able to reverse, which would release the semicarbazide, which would allow it to react with compound B, and therefore make B prime. So if A prime is the thermodynamic product, this reaction will not occur. Since the formation of A prime would be the least reversible. If instead A prime is the kinetic product, it could decompose to form semicarbazide. Technically, of course, we get molecule A back again as well. But it can form semicarbazide which could react with B to form B prime, the thermodynamic product. How can we tell if this reaction occurred or not? And not just because something dissolved and made a solid. Well, if you have A prime, that's a solid that has its own melting point. When you've done this, make the product, you're going to have B prime, which is its own melting point. So the melting point of the initial and the final mixture should be different. Now, I said it this way. The reaction can be said to occur if the melting point of the product differs drastically from the reactant. There's still this issue that our melting points may not be the most accurate in the world. So if we got a melting point of 196, that's going to be close enough to 202 that we say the reaction happened. If you did this and you got a temperature of 158, that's closer to what A would be originally, which is what we'd expect if that does not occur. The other possibility is true as well, that we could react B prime with A and see if anything happened. Did anything happen in that second case? Like in this case where you did take the cyclohexanone derivative and you did this reversal reaction, this is, I forgot to put my label here, but this is part E. What were the results you all got? You didn't get anything? Temperature, yes. 192? 197? Hello, what's wrong with the rest of you? Do you not understand the question? I'm just asking you to look at your data. If you don't want to interact, then go home. But otherwise, please tell me your data so I can know what happened in your experiment. You didn't finish it. Okay. I need to know this. The rest of you? Didn't finish. Next year I collect lab books every lab to make sure the data is being collected. Okay, well, what you hopefully find is like what he had gotten, a higher melting point temperature to show that B prime would form, which is what we expect because B prime is the thermodynamic product. A prime is the kinetic product, so it is able to reverse and it does exactly this, what I've just described. So what you need to put in your lab report then is the following. Of course, give your data, what your different melting points were. Give ranges if you took melting point ranges. I didn't realize till after the fact that I probably didn't comment on the fact that you should record your range. And it is normal, in fact, for some compounds to have a small range of temperatures for the melting point. Now, if you got 10, 20 degrees as your range, then that's a sign that you did your melting point too quickly. But regardless of the size of your range, when doing comparisons, average the low and high temperatures. Now, you don't have to write out in your calculation section that you did the averaging. But just be inclusive of data. Make sure you show all of your different melting points. And then you can jump, after your purpose and data, jump to conclusion. Just say which one of the products is the thermodynamic product, which one's the kinetic. And then your discussion section, you can do the following. Don't tell me what kinetic versus thermodynamic control is. Because I've already told you that's one of the questions on your lab. So you don't need to write all that now since you're going to be writing all of it later. Part you need to talk about is the logic that we've discussed here. That you, on the temperature runs of part C, that's one way to tell which is the kinetic versus the thermodynamic. And you could say it really succinctly, like I did, that whichever product is formed at low temperature is indicative of the kinetic product, and then whichever product matched that melting point is therefore the kinetic product. Whichever product formed at the high temperature, that's the thermodynamic product, and whichever of the reference compounds made in A and B match that, that's the thermodynamic product. And then what we just went over with part E, whichever of the reversibility tests fails or succeeds, one's going to automatically be the opposite of the other. So whichever way you want to describe it, you can, but that's your corroborating evidence of which one is the kinetic product. Because the kinetic product's the only one that'll reverse and do this reaction. And this is due, not this Wednesday, but the Wednesday after. So I think that makes it the 21st. So not this Wednesday, but the following Wednesday. 21st? Okay, good. Any questions then what to do with this lab report? Any questions over the theory we covered today? Right, so since we already know what happened in this experiment, then let's look at that other potential reaction we could do. B prime plus A should give us B prime plus A. Because in this case, since B prime is the thermo product, no reaction occurs, which means the melting point should still match whatever we get for B prime. So actually, both reversibility tests, you should have gotten the same melting point. Because in one, it reversed to make the thermodynamic product. The other, you already had the thermodynamic product, which didn't reverse. Does that make sense? There's no more questions, then I would like to do some more work with NMR today, and there's two specific examples that I'd like to give. And I'd like to give them both to you at the same time so you can have a few minutes to try to work on them before we go over the answers. Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead. We still haven't talked about three and four. So five is going to be due first. Six, that's what we were starting to work on in lecture today, is the background for that. So as soon as we can get through all the theory, then I'll put a due date on it. Three and four, you may end up just answering something about those on your lab quiz or something. We'll see. So let's get to these two examples. First example is a molecule with a halogen. So C5H11Cl. And let me get you the absorbance data in one moment. So that compound has three absorbances, one at 1.764. That's a quartet that integrates to 1.556. That's a singlet that integrates to 6. And 1.036, which is a triplet that integrates to 3. Separate problem. A pure hydrocarbon with a formula C8H10. It only has two absorbances at 704 for a singlet that integrates to 4 and 2.296 for a singlet that integrates to 6. You might need your chemical shift charts from either your lecture text or your lab text. So if you don't have either one of those available, you might gather around so you can share. But go ahead and spend 5 minutes or so and see if you can solve for the structure of these compounds. Our first compound, C5H11Cl, how many degrees of unsaturation? 0. So it is truly just an alkyl halide, not an alkenyl or alkynyl halide. Now I'm going to solve this three different ways. And yes, in some sense, these are three different tricks. Last one actually isn't so much a trick, it's more methodical. But the reason, yet again, that I'm showing you these tricks is because otherwise, how would I? You got to start somewhere learning some of the ways to analyze NMR compounds, and as you keep doing more problems, you'll start remembering, oh, try that, look at that, think about that. That's the point of all these examples. So method one is going to be the chemical shift method. Now, let me look around here. What, did nobody look at your chemical shift charts? Because it would have revealed some very important information to you. That for a hydrogen that is on the same carbon as a chlorine, that has a chemical shift of approximately 3.5. Whereas a hydrogen that is one more position away has a chemical shift more like 1.7. So this method one I'm calling the chemical shift approach is based actually right here. We don't have any hydrogens with chemical shift greater than 2, do we? So we don't have any hydrogens on a carbon that's next to the chlorine. What does that mean? That means I know this much of the molecular structure just from that one piece of information. Because if there's no hydrogens at that position, the only other thing you could have is carbons. There's only 4 carbons in this compound to begin with, so no matter where you put the 4th compound, you're going to get the same structure. That is the answer. Let me cover it again. On the basis of chemical shift, we have hydrogen's right on the position where the chlorine is, or hydrogen's that's one more position away, at least the two that I've listed here. And we do have chemical shift of 1.7. So yes, we do have hydrogens that are one more position away. But we don't have anything with a chemical shift greater than 2, so we have no hydrogens on the position where the chlorine is attached. We only have carbon, hydrogen, and chlorine. So if we can't have hydrogens, we already used up the chlorine, then that means all the three other positions have to be carbons. Again, based on the molecular formula, since there's only one other carbon, we don't even have to worry where it is. Put it on any of those methyl groups, and you get the right compound. But this is only one approach. Did anybody use this approach? Okay. Any questions about this approach? Yeah. Of course you are. There'll be problems where you have to use the chemical shift tables. That's part of the reason I'm giving you this example. To show that logic alone may not be enough. You might need that chemical shift info. Yeah. I'm going to provide you a complete and easily readable enough table that you'll be able to use it on your problems. Now let's go to another method then. And here we'll use symmetry. Because notice that we have something that integrates to 6. The only way physically you can have something that integrates to 6 is if you have more than one carbon that are chemically equivalent to each other. For example, you can have 2 methyl groups, maybe both attached to the same carbon. In theory, we could have 3 methylene groups, 3 CH2 groups that are all symmetric. Although given the limited number of atoms that we have, not very likely scenario. It is, in theory, possible that we have 6 identical carbons, each with having one hydrogen on it. The compound benzene, for example, would integrate to 6. But we don't even have 6 carbons. We only have 5. So beyond unlikely that we're going to have 6 equivalent positions. But we know that there's symmetry of some sort. So, given an integration of 6, there must be at least 2 chemically equivalent groups, either 2 methyl groups or 3 methylene groups. I won't even write down that bit about 6 individually equivalent carbons, because you're not going to have a case like that in any example you get this year, except for benzene. So, based on the number of atoms, though, I would say it's unlikely even that you'll have three methylene groups that are equivalent to each other. Maybe because some people learn better by pictures, I should write down some physical examples. So here are two molecules unrelated to this problem that have two equivalent methyl groups or three equivalent methylenes. But based on the small size of the molecule, it is much more likely that it has two equivalent methyl groups. So let's start with that guess. Because if we put two methyl groups that are, let's say, connected to the same carbon, both will be equivalent. We have an integration of six. So what if we use part of the rest of the information that's given to us? This peak that does integrate to six, what is its splitting pattern? I didn't quite hear you. I gave it to you right at the beginning. Peak that integrates to six is a singlet. How many neighbors does a singlet have then? Zero. So, first I started with symmetry, guessing that there are two equivalent methyl groups. I've now used the splitting pattern, though, that would be generated by those methyl groups to show that there are no hydrogens. And there's only two possible combinations then. That either I attach a chlorine there, and then off of the other carbon, there would be an ethyl group. Or I do it this way. But that would make three equivalent methyl groups. So that's not the answer. So just based on symmetry and looking at one splitting pattern, I'm able to come up with the structure of the compound. Now, how many of you use some of this reasoning? The idea that there might be two equivalent methyl groups. Okay. But there is a third method, which is just to use splitting. And how can we do that? Well, we have a triplet that integrates to 3, which that integration to 3 usually is going to mean it's a methyl group. Integration to 3 technically could be 3 equivalent single hydrogens, but most of the time, I'd say 98% of the time of the problems you'll work at least, an integration to 3 means a methyl group. Why is that useful? Well, it's useful because you mean you're at the end of a molecule. So if you have an end piece, then if you can work from that into the interior of the molecule, you're solving the structure, and you've got a pretty good confidence in what you're solving for because you started at one end. So in this example, there's a triplet that integrates to 3. What does that mean? How many hydrogens will those 3 hydrogens have as neighbors? Only 2, because that's what a triplet means. Which means that the next position over must be a carbon. Why? Because if it's not hydrogen, well, the only other thing it can be is carbon or chlorine. We put a chlorine there, we have a 2-carbon molecule, and chlorine ends it. But that's not the case. We have a larger molecule than that, so it has to be a carbon. What goes there? Well, what is the integration of the peak that integrates to 2? I'm sorry, what is the splitting of the peak that integrates to 2? A quartet, right? Well, quartet means it has 3 neighbors. Yeah, we see that. It also means it has no other neighbors. What does that mean? That only carbons and chlorines can go there. And so one more time, we solve the structure of the compound. The only peak that integrates to 2 is a quartet. Which means it only has hydrogen neighbors. On one side. So, through one way or another, how many of you got the structure of this compound? And maybe you randomly guessed, which at least if you could, if you can make a correspondence between the splitting patterns in the compound and verified you got the right answer, well, that's sometimes how these things happen. To verify the rest of the splitting, we have the singlet that integrates to 6. That's the two methyl groups that are blocked by splitting because of that chlorine. We have the triplet that integrates to 3, so that would be here, because it's split by the two neighbors. And then the quartet that integrates to 2, the two here that only have the methyl group as neighbors. Any questions on this compound? Let's quickly wrap up the last case. That was our pure hydrocarbon, C8H10. Which has how many degrees of unsaturation? 4. Which opens up all kinds of possibilities. It could be 2 triple bonds. It could be a triple bond with 2 rings, a triple bond with 2 double bonds, a triple bond with a ring and a double bond, 4 double bonds, 3 double bonds in a ring, 2 double bonds and 2 rings, or a double bond and 3 rings. Now, how did I figure all that out? Because triple bond counts for 2 degrees on saturation. So if I have 2 triple bonds, that's it. If I have 1 triple bond, well, then I have 2 more that I have to do something with. And they can either be rings, double bonds, or 1 of each. If I don't have any triple bonds, then I've got the 4 degrees of unsaturation, which could either be a combination of different double bonds and rings. So it doesn't seem to help us much, except, and if unless any of you looked at the chemical shift information, because we have a chemical shift of one of our peaks above 7. There are not that many functional groups that show up above 7. But one of them that does is benzene. How many degrees of unsaturation does benzene have? 4. Because benzene is a ring with 3 double bonds. So that adds up to 4 degrees of unsaturation. That fits. So on average, depending on the substituent on the benzene ring, it generally falls in the 7 to 8 region. Or what does the text say, actually, for benzene? Are you looking that up right now? 253, I think, might be the page. Here, let me... it could be tough to find it quickly.
First time you use it. That's the IR absorbances. Oh, so I did remember the IR. NMR is ahead of that. So,
so that 7 to 8 range is kind of in the middle. It just calls them aromatic hydrogen. 270 what? 268? Page 268? Okay. So like I said, though, on the real exam, you will have your own table. But for practice problems, you need to start using these tables because it helps. So the combination of having 4 degrees of unsaturation and a chemical shift that's in the right range, we're going to guess that this is some kind of benzene compound. Which, since it's only C8, that means other than the benzene ring itself, it's only got 2 carbons. So there's only 4 possible answers. So let's determine how many different hydrogens are on each of these compounds. Because we only have two absorbances. The one at 7, it's a singlet, and then we have integration of 6. And in fact, I'll approach this a little differently than I did the last time I covered this for the other two sections. If you have an integration of 6, what does that mean? It means what? Symmetric carbons, right? Is an ethyl group going to give you an integration of 6? How many hydrogens are in an ethyl group? 5. The other three compounds, we have 2 methyl groups. In all 3 of those compounds, the methyl groups are equivalent because there's symmetry in all 3 of those compounds. So all 3 of those would give us an integration of 6, at least as one of our possible peaks. So just on the basis of symmetry alone, I can eliminate the last one as a possibility. And just to help confirm this, how many different types of hydrogens are on this compound? Did I hear someone say 6? 6? How many types? 3? 5? 6? 5? This is the same thing that happened this morning. If anybody hears this lecture, it's not in this class, they think, what kind of OCHEM is this? They're just sitting around shouting out numbers. 5. Why? The ethyl group has 2 types of hydrogens. There is no hydrogen where the ethyl group is. That's got 4 bonds already. So hopefully you didn't put a hydrogen there. There is, however, the hydrogen on either side of the ethyl group. There's 1 more hydrogen over. And then there's the one at the opposite end of the methyl group. So we have 5 absorbances. All right, let's count the number of absorbances in the other compound. So moving one to the left, the ortho case, how many types of hydrogens? 3? 4? 3? 4? 3. Why? Because the methyl groups are the same. It's symmetric. That means one half of the molecule is the same as the other. And so we only get 3 absorbances. The next one over, how many there? 4. Yes. 1 between the methyl groups. 2 on either side. 3, again between the methyl groups, and 4, the methyl groups themselves. That better mean that this last one is the right answer, and it is. But because the molecule is doubly symmetric, if you cut it horizontally, if you cut it vertically, there's mirror planes in both directions. So all 4 of the benzene hydrogens are equivalent to each other. Since they are all 4 equivalent to each other, that's the only way, in fact, that we're going to end up with just one other singlet that integrates to 4. Look at the other benzene compounds. For the ortho case, even if the substituents are symmetric, you always have 2 types of hydrogens. For the meta case, you'll always have 3 types of hydrogens. So on the number of absorbances alone, we are able to identify this as paraxylene. questions? So with whatever time you have remaining, order of priority is work on the IRs for experiment 6, finish up your melting points on experiment 5, and then if any of you have anything from experiments 3 or 4 left over, work on those. If any of you happen to have been so organized that you're already done, if you could wait around just for a few moments, I'm going to have your exams ready to hand back. We won't cover the answers today, but at least you can have your exams back.